KBOO Portland.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Corey Ilya, and welcome to Trippy Politics Protest and
Potpourri.
And so we have a very special guest in today, Dr. Zapata from the Homeless Research and Action Collaborative of PSU. And I've actually met Dr. Zapata here a while ago during my first article writing about the creation of the Homeless Research and Action Collaborative. Say hello to our guests. Introduce yourself.
Hello. As Corey said, I'm Dr. Marisa Zapata. I'm the director of the Homelessness Research Action Collaborative, and I'm also an associate professor of land use planning and urban studies and planning.
Nice. So just recently, I think it was not even a week ago, there was actually a study out of the Homeless Research and Action Collaborative authored by you, and it was actually stating that there is 38,000 homeless in the Multnomah County,
Tri-County.
So 38,000 in the Tri-County area, and this was just after the HUD point time count came out. So maybe you can explain a little bit more about the study. Like, how did you guys get to that number?
Yeah, so the study covers three different topic areas. One was looking at costs to address homelessness and to prevent homelessness in the Tri-County area. And in order to do that, we wanted to develop a more realistic count related to people experiencing homelessness. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development does what's called a point-in-time count every 2 years. I think the important thing for your listeners to understand is that the point-in-time count is governed by HUD's definition of homelessness. HUD's definition of homelessness is very, very restricted, and it only includes people who are living unsheltered, meaning in tents or in cars, people who are living in emergency shelter or transitional housing. That excludes people who are living doubled and tripled up, people who are sharing other people's housing, living in sheds or attics, what we might think of as couch surfing, but not because your kid doesn't feel like getting a job couch surfing, yeah. Right? It's when you're actually housing your cousin's best friend's kid because they have no place to go and you just can't bear to see them on the street.
Okay. I feel like oftentimes these people are still paying other bills, but they just don't have enough for housing.
Right. So phone bills, credit card bills, a lot of times they're working.
Vehicle and transportation, whether mm-hmm. they take public transit or not.
Yes, transportation, all of the things. One of the things that we've actually seen on campus is we'll see students and staff get parking permits in order to actually be able to live in our parking garages. If you're a student, you're automatically allowed to use the rec center as part of your fees. And so then you have a shower and a bathroom. And so you can stay in your car. Nice. You're allowed to be there legally. It's much cheaper than rent.
I'm a PCC student, and we have to pay a separate fee to use the gym where the showers are. But you can essentially hang out in the parking lot if you're a student with the parking permit. They have never bothered anyone that I've noticed that is a student there. But you don't often see a lot of people hanging out like that. I didn't know PSU had so many students in that situation.
I mean, I myself do a lot of the reporting at PSU for the homeless situation in and around campus, and I myself knew there was a few people living in vehicles near and around campus, but I didn't know in the structures and stuff like that either.
I don't know how many it is. This is from what the campus police had told us, because they leave those folks alone.
Okay.
So we've been meeting with campus police to understand when and where and how they're responding to people. And one of the specific things was is that they see people who are obviously living in cars and vehicles. Okay. As long as they have parking permits, they didn't bother them.
Okay.
But yeah, going back to the number question. So the 38,000 came from really was the point in time count is a one night count. We looked at an annualization rate. So that means across the entire year, how many people do we actually think experienced homelessness? And so we looked at the actual utilization rates of shelter, which I think puts us up into like 16,000.
Wow. So that's how many people are checking into shelters.
Yep. And okay. It's individual people. So duplicates are removed.
Okay.
And then an annualized rate is applied to the unsheltered count that came from some work that's been done at the joint office and then what HUD has done around veterans. And then what really pushes the number up is that the Department of Education actually counts people who are living doubled up as homeless in their counts. And so every fall, they release their previous year counts of everyone who experienced homelessness across the previous year who was a youth. And so we included those numbers, and that got us up to 38,000. It's actually the least complicated part of the entire report. It was literally three sets of numbers we added together, did some research on to see if we could feel good about that and put it out.
What do you think was one of the more challenging parts of the report then?
The hardest thing to do technically is the cost estimates. The market's always changing, trying to understand how much it might cost to build housing, how much it might cost to provide services. We did a lot of using estimates that were already done in other reports because we didn't want to contradict what other reports had done. A lot of those reports had great processes, but it becomes very shaky when you start mounting assumptions on assumptions.
Yeah. As far as I've understood, there's like multiple ways to define homelessness, HUDs. The Oxford Dictionary version, the McKinney-Vento
Act.
So basically, did you like use a little bit of all three to get this number?
Yes, I would say that what we came closest to was the Department of Education definition, which was created through the McKinney-Vento Act.
What's the exact wording there?
So they're thinking about homelessness as people who are economically or who are. With the doubled up part, they're thinking about people who are economically unable to access housing and are forced to share it. A Home for Everyone, which is the multi-jurisdictional process to address homelessness in Multnomah County, also has a doubled up definition, but they focus more on what's called unsafely doubled up. Okay. And that was really thinking about situations in which you're letting someone live with you, maybe on your couch, but it's a violation of your HUD voucher. Or it's a violation of your lease, or you kicked into overcrowding. So something that puts you at risk for also losing your housing.
Yeah, I'm basically a person having a heart trying to give somebody a place that they're not really permitted to.
I've known a few people in that position, actually. A veteran and his son were on the voucher program, but they had a few friends that didn't have stability in their life and had offered them couch crashing space, and they were always in concern that they would lose their own housing if it got found out, but they couldn't just let these people sleep on the streets every night.
Exactly. And I think one of the disservices that HUD does by focusing on such a narrow definition is that it's not acknowledging how many people are doing this and then figuring out how to provide support to them as well.
It's almost punitive, saying if you've helped somebody else, if we find out that there's a greater need for our services, we're going to punish you because you let someone house with you under our voucher.
See, one thing I've been personally kind of wondering, too, is like how many other universities or whatnot on the West Coast or nationally have actually even done something similar to what HRAC has done. And like maybe exposed the problem a little bit more because of the HUD definition. If it's constraining that hard, that means the numbers in like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle aren't quite capturing what's going on.
Yeah, so LA County actually has what they call the county estimate, I believe is what they call it.
Okay.
And it's a similar thing. So they actually release a count like this.
Okay, because I've heard a number out of there of something like 125,000.
Yeah, I don't remember what their actual count is. I think the hard thing when we start comparing a lot of these jurisdictions is that the population size is enormous. But they do a county estimate that does include a lot of, it focuses on an annualized rate.
Okay.
But there aren't a lot of universities that do this. And again, I'm not sure why or why not. I mean, if I had realized how much attention this would get and how impactful it could have been, I would have added these three numbers up 5 years ago and put a report cover on it.
I feel you there. I'm actually thinking from now on of kind of citing your guys' number as really what's the number.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things we've tried to do, and I've pushed back to some folks on Twitter, is people will try to say, well, there's HUD homeless and then there's other homeless. And I'm like, nope. It's all homeless.
Yes.
Stop saying HUD. You can say HUD homeless, but it's not an asterisk. Doubled up is not an asterisk.
Well, that makes me wonder, how can we get these terminologies synced together so that the definitions are the same? So when people say houseless or homeless, they fall under the same definition of homeless.
So I think there's a few challenges, and one that I really want to acknowledge. A lot of the people who've done homelessness advocacy work are very much opposed to including Doubled Up. And the reason for that is, well, there's a lot of reasons. I think the one reason that I think resonates with me is the fear that it won't result in a bigger pie to eat from, but it will reduce in more people getting fewer and smaller slices of pie from the resource bucket.
I feel like that's a standard fear that gets put out there about a lot of things.
It does. I want to acknowledge it because this is what I get yelled at about.
I kind of feel you there. And like I myself kind of consider myself as an advocate journalist when it comes to the homeless situation, because I've been around, I've learned so much about it, I know what's going on in and out. And that right there is a hard determination for me, too. I'd have to say the fact that Double Up's included in there actually kind of forces HUD's hand to provide better support of the situation.
I would agree. I would say it's almost like the medical oath, you know, saying if you can do good, if you know that there's a problem, you can't ignore it.
Yeah.
And if you know that these numbers are doubled, tripled, that you have this many people needing resources, you can't then just cut the resources. I think there's an ethical concerns with that as well.
Yeah, it's something that, I mean, I think that we really tried to do with this report, and we're turning all of our work towards, is thinking about not wanting to get engaged with what I call oppression or poverty Olympics. And I understand that that's what the system has done. White supremacy has pitted all of us against each other. But when we fight over who is in the worst case scenario, HUD actually has a definitional category called worst case housing needs as a way to help people understand who needs help most. I'm like, everyone's fucked. Everyone is fucked. Right? So can we just help the people who are fucked?
You just got to start somewhere, really. Yeah. You got to start somewhere. So like if someone comes to you and you say, look, whatever your particular issues are right now, I have access to you. I have access to the things that'll help resolve your situation to get you in a better position, that'll stay in a better position, and just take it person by person as you're capable of helping them. I think that's how you get a job done.
I mean, there was an article, I can't remember where it was from. I think it was one of the New York Times or Post, and it was talking to The Guardian, and it was talking about how 20% of Americans are a $400 emergency away from basically falling into the situation and being homeless. And I mean, I myself as a college student know that with all my bills, phone, rent, everything else, I barely just squeak by.
Yeah, and I think the college student part in particular really resonates with me because there's so much class privilege that is employed in our language when we think about college. And so one of the things that we've heard from folks when we said we're doing a study about how our students and staff experience homelessness on campus was that, I lived with 5 roommates in a rundown house in a bad neighborhood. And it was like, yeah, but that was a temporary status for you. And you had the option to call your parents and end that if you wanted.
Yes.
And that is very different than having 10 students crammed into 3 bedrooms with black mold growing in the bathroom, and they can't call the landlord because they can't be evicted.
Exactly.
Those are categorically different things.
Yeah. I mean, the latter is probably more extreme case and is not as common as the first one. But yeah, I mean, I see that. And I mean, yeah, where I'm at right now is a very precarious place to be kind of for housed. I'm helping my mother, like clearing out my grandfather's house, and I'm watching over the house, so it gives me room and board. And so I have to pay not only my bills and all that extra on the side, I'm taking care of like dental and extra stuff I'm having to catch back up on, which gives me a bit of a grace period while I'm trying to get myself stabilized. But still, I mean, that's going to be gone within the next couple months, it sounds like. So.
Yeah, and I think that we don't really listen to the stories of people who go through this kind of housing insecurity. Right? What does it do to you to be like, where am I going to be living in 6 months?
Mm-hmm.
Do I have enough money saved up? Am I going to have to throw my stuff away, or can I find friends to move my stuff? How many days of school have my kid missed, right? All of these things take a toll psychologically, physically, in terms of educational attainment, economic goals. It's pretty serious.
On top of that, when someone there's the other obvious issues when someone is unstable is their hygiene situation. Every single day you have to make food, cook food. You need to, you know, wash your body and go to the bathroom. And where are you going to take a shit? yeah. When you wake up in the morning,
where's my morning poo?
And what
drop?
If you get sick? Where are you going to vomit? How are you going to clean that up? How are you going to clean your stuff? You got to take dirty laundry with you across town to the laundromat. It's not as simple as when you have a home to get these things together. You're taking all your possessions with you everywhere you go.
Yeah, this is one of the areas where I'm just like, how can people not have a heart about that? Mm-hmm. You know, why is the response to seeing someone poop in the St. John's Town Center, why is that a response of hate towards that person?
Instead of empathy and saying, yeah. Wow, that you had nowhere else to go. The porta potties are locked up at night at the parks or construction sites, and businesses won't let you use the restroom.
Well, right. See, and I've done the research myself here, too. There's only 8 public restrooms, I believe, in the downtown quarters that are open, and those are shut down at certain hours. If there's a protest, they're locked.
They were locked when we were down there on the 17th, I believe.
And this is Portland. There's a lot of protests. So those bathrooms tend to get locked.
So we actually, I've had some students this summer looking at the ways in which people in recreation and people in natural disaster and people who are doing homelessness work talk about hygiene work. When you go to a national park, what are those hygiene facilities like?
Yeah.
They're gorgeous. And so why can't we have that in our city? Why can't we have urban rest stops? In terms of recreation, one of the things that I get very angry about is in Portland, we're talking about how pro-recreation we are. Everyone should go ride their bikes on a bike trail. But, you know, a lot of people, especially women, have smaller bladders. Mm-hmm. And they can't just go to the bathroom on any trail.
Even teenagers, little kids, the elderly that want to go out for a walk or get used to riding a bike, where are they going to use the restroom? Are you going to make them buy a coffee every other mile to use the bathroom?
And this is kind of what frustrates me, too, about the Springwater Trail.
It's classist.
The Springwater Trail is fairly encamped, but I only know of one bathroom along that whole thing, and it's down at like 42nd or 39th or whatever it is.
Yeah. Why don't we have composting toilets on our trails? And I think that, again, the reason that, the answer to that is that we're always building these things and thinking about these things from a classed, gendered and racialized perspective. So we've got some different models out there. The city, I think, has just put a call out for people to welcome hygiene trailers to their parking lots.
Yes, I remember hearing that one.
Yeah, and then we're looking and working with a group that does like stickers and windows for businesses that are willing to let people use their bathrooms.
Nice.
But that's not a systematic solution, right? We've got this whole like, we got to do triage right now. But how do we get to the long-term solution?
And they're all little separate pieces. There needs to be something that really helps them tie together.
Yep.
Yeah, which kind of, you know, jumps me into another topic I wanted to talk to you about is the Portland Street Response, which was a report out of Street Roots that gained a lot of popularity. And, like, I was kind of seeing maybe what your take on that one was. It started because of the 52% of arrests were of the homeless, and most of those were for unwanted people. And it's basically trying to take away the officers as the first responders and respond and switch them with a mental health worker and crisis worker.
Yeah, so I'm a woman of color. Anything that gets emergency response out of the hands of police when it's not necessary, which is a significant portion of the time, I'm going to cheer about. We've been doing a report or doing some research with Commissioner Hardesty's office and Street Roots to really see what would be a helpful way of trying to set this up. I think it's a great step. It's not going to solve all the problems right away. And I think one of the things was interesting, we looked over the surveys that folks, you did surveying, right?
Yes. Yeah. I led Gregory's team, Greg.
Townley?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I did one, there was Maggie Vespa from KGW and another Street Roots vendor. And yeah, we went out there to 92nd Flavel because I know that area pretty well. The individual who's supposed to lead that one was actually Ibrahim from Right to Survive, who didn't show up that day or showed up late, I think it was. And I was like, yeah, I know the area, I can lead. So, yeah, we went up there. We did some surveying. We talked to, I want to say between the four of us, at least a dozen people in that area. Like Did you actually look at some of the responses for that?
Yeah, I helped analyze the surveys. I went through them, the short answer questions, and helped compile them and start trying to make sense out of them. You know, the things that I think stand out to other people, they weren't terribly surprising to me, but that, you know, a lot of people who were houseless want the police to come in certain circumstances. And so it's not that everyone doesn't want the police or hates the police. They recognize there are circumstances in which armed officers may be the most effective response. And a lot of them reported having very positive interactions. The thing that I think is heartbreaking that seems to surprise people is the number of times the police don't come when someone who is houseless calls.
Yes.
And says, I need assistance. Or they come and they don't do anything.
Or they come and then they end up making the person the victim or the one that's causing the problem.
Yep. And I heard a couple of stories that were just absolutely heartbreaking. I'm not sure if I can share them because they were in the focus group, but just some really astounding moments of police completely disregarding the actual violence that was done to someone.
Yeah.
At the same time, I also know that housed residents are saying the same thing. They call the police and the police are coming and not doing anything.
This is a story I'm willing to share on the air and needs to get out there. When I was homeless myself back in 2012, it was like late fall, early winter. I was staying in a tent and it was like 6 a.m. in the morning. And I got woke up by a rifle muzzle to my face. A fully SWAT-geared officer kneeled at the entrance of my tent telling me, don't move. But the officer who was his partner on the outside of my tent was, oh, time to go. So I'm sitting there scared, shitless, with a gun rifle to my face trying to figure out what these guys want me to do. And yeah, I still to this day wake up in the middle of the night with a start.
And this is what I think what also just I think further enrages me about police topics is that people don't recognize that these things carry with you, right? This is not like a cute cocktail story that you tell and it's like, oh, you're great, you're fine, right? This is a trauma and nobody's helping you resolve that trauma. Maybe the police, if you're lucky, apologize to you. But these things keep going on.
Actually, that one got even worse. They ended up taking my stuff, dumping it out in the dirt, looking for drug paraphernalia, destroyed my tent, told me to move on or I'd be arrested. I ended up spending that night in 20-degree weather underneath the 92nd Max Overpass Bridge in not significant enough clothing. I ended up getting TB, tuberculosis. I ended up in the hospital.
That's terrible. There's a lot of people, unfortunately, still living in situations like that. And that's probably why they've been fed up and tired with dealing with certain authorities and police and rangers.
What really was surprising was that there were several stories of which police were responding how you would want them to, like human beings.
Right.
And so then I'm like, well, what is it about policing? And obviously we can talk about the history and legacy of policing and how it's set up that stops so many police officers from that humane response.
Yeah. I kind of see it too, because I've interacted with like a lot of the officers and the homeless up there in houseless up there in Lentz, specifically 92nd Flavel along that strip of this trail. There are certain officers that are quite nice, very hospitable, very helping to these people. And then there's ones that you don't want to be around when they show up.
Right.
And even the nice ones, every once in a while, I do see some agitation get to them. And sometimes it's not even the agitation of dealing with the homeless there. It's the dealing with, hey, having to get called back out there. And, some of these officers, they're really great guys. They do a lot. They do try and help. But at the same time, there's other ones that just give that a bad name.
So the Portland Street Response report should be coming out in the next few weeks. There is going to be, I think, a press conference in a couple of weeks that talk about the survey findings and the focus group findings and recommendations from the work that was done on people who are houseless. Another survey went out to business owners.
Okay.
To see if they've called on people who are houseless, why? and what else could be done instead of making that call.
So is there one going out to like the general population in Portland?
I don't know. That would be a question for Greg. Okay. There's a community outreach team that's working out of the commissioner's office, and they were doing both. So we didn't have anything to do with the business survey. Part of what's interesting being in this center is the kind of research that we're tagging into. And I always hesitate to get a ton of information from people unless we can actually do something meaningful with it. And so, like, what would a general survey to the public be right now? How would we actually be able to use that in a short period of time to get the program going? Is that like a building the plane while flying it type of thing?
So, what do you think with the report, you know, the 38,000, what do you think are the next steps going forward from here? Like,
well, in the report, so in addition to the cost estimates and the counts, we did some work around regional governance and then some stuff around revenue raising options. And I think that the big thing is that the region doesn't have a housing strategy. And a lot of people are like, well, we don't have any housing, so we know that's what we need. Well, the thing is that housing costs different amounts based on where it's located, how it's built, who builds it, how many units it is. And then if you're having to put in supports, that is going to add additional costs. We don't know what it means to say focus on people who are making 0 to 30% of median household income. If we built exclusively for that income bracket, what would then happen for people who are 60 to 80% median household income? If we built just for 60 to 80%, what would happen at 0 to 30%? Are we taking into account that we have naturally occurring affordable housing in the region that's being lost every day? So what does it look like to actually lay out the things that are happening in the region and then come up with a strategic plan on this is how we're going to tackle each of these parts? Maybe the next step is we're going to go after a service revenue measure in order to get services for the housing that has been created by the Metro Bond. Maybe that's the next step. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's we do that while we're identifying the next 10 steps. You know, my fear right now is that we're in such a reactionary mode that we're just picking paths and doing them. And that works for the short term. But the long term reality is that we're not getting out of an affordable housing crisis anytime soon.
See, I've been listening to like the crisis thrown around so many times, housing crisis, homeless crisis. In my book, this is a humanitarian crisis. And I say that because there is a very serious lack of humanity that is not being expressed towards these people.
There's a very diminished quality of life that they have as well. And that's the people in this country, the amount of them that are having this diminished quality of life due to economic disadvantage, due to being, you know, housing insecure, food insecure, social, all sorts of problems. That's a problem, and it's a big problem.
I mean, right now, I'm proud to admit that I'm probably counted amongst that 38,000 that you guys captured within that study because of my situation. So I guess I am a homeless journalist.
Because you are, you're couch surfing right now.
Yeah. So, and even if you weren't, even if you didn't meet a quote definition for that, you would certainly be in one of the 107,000 households we found facing serious housing insecurity or at risk of homelessness.
And see,
you're in one of those groups.
See, and this is what really bothers me too, is I kind of want to, I don't know if you have the numbers off the top of your head. I'm trying to figure out like the median income or the average income for a single person in the area and like the average income for like rent for a single room or studio. And I feel that those are very disproportional. And that the end result is essentially having to couple up with somebody, make yourself into an, jump into a relationship essentially just to have the two forms of income to essentially be able to.
That's how a lot of domestic violence situations occur. You have people that are choosing to rely on each other, that are blending their lives, their incomes, and their outcomes on what happens with one person or the other. And if somebody doesn't have good self-control with the money they got that day or the food that they have or the space and the privacy, they can lose one of those things and it all starts falling apart. It can become a very violent situation. There's a lot of different forms of abuse, whether it can be physical or emotional. So unfortunately, it's actually doing a lot of damage to people. Like you said, it's a humanitarian issue.
Yeah, and I think that that's also underscored with elder abuse. So now one of the fastest growing populations to experience homelessness for the first time in their lives are seniors.
Oh, yes. I've been hearing about this one, too.
Yeah, and I think it gets back to this point you're making. I just checked median household income or median family income for the Portland region is $72,000 a year. I'm not sure if that what family size that is, if it's a family of one or four.
Okay.
But the reality is what matters is that we know that there's a dramatic mismatch between wages and price of housing. And that is the number one cause of homelessness, right?
Yeah.
It's the lack of having a house. Now, I want to pause and say it does not mean that if we have a low homelessness count, we have quality housing. And so one of the things that I've seen floating around is this like, West Virginia has higher rates of opioid overdose, but lower rates of homelessness than Oregon. That's a shock, right? That's a shock.
Yeah.
But
why are we even comparing that the opioids to the houseless? They're just
yeah. And so it's trying to be a myth buster to the belief that opioid addiction is causing homelessness. But I think what becomes even more problematic in some of these discussions around homelessness is that it's also implying that really shitty housing is acceptable housing.
And it's not.
And it's
yeah,
not.
Right. And so I always want to say, like, yeah, so I might be the question for me is I don't want to just get you into a shelter or a shitty house. I want to get you into quality, stable, long-term, affordable housing. And the way that our income is going up and our rents are going up and our income is staying flat or even diminishing means that we're so far away from achieving that. And I do describe this as a humanitarian crisis. The other thing I like to point out to people, though, and I wrote an op-ed about this recently, is that it's not a natural disaster crisis.
No.
Right? This did not happen overnight.
This was not natural.
Right. It was entirely man-made. And it goes back to our foundations, right? So when we talk about women stuck with partners, when we talk about people of color being overrepresented in homelessness populations, we're talking about foundational decisions in our country to deprive property, salary to people who are not affluent, white, cisgendered, heterosexual men. And so, you know, we're actually asking people to completely reorient themselves to how we care for one another. And that's where I think that care component really comes in, because we're at a precipice. We have to decide how we want to be in community with each other. Do we really care about each other in the way that this would actually have to happen?
What kind of research or what kind of studies are you guys hoping to come out of the Homeless Research and Action Collaborative? And maybe since the viewers aren't fully sure, maybe give a little bit of the description of what the Homeless Research and Action Collaborative
is. Yeah, what is HRAC all about?
What are we doing?
Yeah.
We're a university-wide research center. A year ago, the university launched a competition to identify research centers of excellence that would receive $1.5 million initial investment to launch a center.
Okay.
And we came together across a bunch of different departments and colleges within the university. We have faculty involved in the School of Business, which, let me tell you, shocked me. When I saw like School of Business on the list to show up, I was like, ugh. We all have to have our stereotypes challenged. And the business person will now actually become our assistant director starting on Tuesday.
Oh, nice.
So that's really exciting. So, yeah, we've got people from all of the departments you could imagine. And we came together over five initiative areas. The first being homelessness at PSU. So understanding how students and staff are experiencing homelessness.
Which I have to give a disclaimer. I actually helped do a little bit of editing on that study.
That's right. You did
Greg.
The pre-testing.
Yes. I did the pre-testing for Greg and gave my input. So.
Yeah. Awesome.
I don't remember you telling me that.
Yeah. I met up with Greg. It was just an off day and just met up with him just. Had lunch and did the survey with
him. Just happened
him.
To be working on yeah. that survey. Interesting.
And we've expanded that. We also want to be thinking about how we're going to help people who are living on our campus who may not be defined as part of the PSU community otherwise. One of the big challenges we're really facing is that we do have issues with people living in our buildings. And the question is, when is that a problem? How is that a problem? What does it mean for us to lock down some buildings? You know, it is a challenge if people are cooking heroin or meth in yeah. the bathrooms or leaving needles behind. You know, I try to remind everyone that there is a drug problem and a homelessness problem.
They're not always the
same.
They're
not always the same. I cannot right. actually help with the drug problem.
They intersect at a point, yes. but they are not the same problem.
Yes. And they don't have to go together. There's many people that have a drug problem that are totally yeah. housed, that have jobs. You might or might not know.
Yeah.
Right. But there are people that are unhoused without any drug problems and might just smoke cigarettes.
Yep.
And maybe they're having a physical or mental issue, and that is what is behind their issue.
Yeah, maybe their PTSD keeps them from getting a job, and how hard that is when you're already homeless. When you're already homeless, it's harder to get a job, harder to find a place that will rent a room to you because you don't have rental history. So I could see the problem of people like wandering in buildings and using these facilities. I've seen that on my campus. Up here in North Portland at PCC, Cascade, there are some people that just sit down on the couch and enjoy a cool place to rest. But there are other people that will lock themselves in the bathroom for half an hour. You don't know what they're doing. And it smells funny when they come out. So that's a problem.
Yeah. And what I'm trying to just really encourage is that we have to think about being part of a regional solution. And, you know, what I've told some people who want to lock the buildings down is that, okay, well, we can do that. But the literal consequence of that is that we are then locking people out and shifting them someplace else. Yeah. And so we are, you know, there's a lot of philosophical issues with that. But there's also just the, like, is that being a good partner downtown issue?
And if you were to ever meet the homeless liaison officer, I believe it's still Officer Peter Ward, I believe, I hope.
I don't know.
I've met Peter before, and he is awesome. So you want to be his friend the moment you meet him. So he's a great person.
I had to call the interim chief of police last week over something.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll reach out
to
Peter.
PSU
now.
Campus police. Yes. I'm not a PSU student, so yeah. I'm not as familiar as both of you with all of these.
Yeah.
Did you think I was familiar with the campus police?
I've had to speak to mine a few times, but that's because I called them to let them know there was some scary stuff happening.
There are issues, right? And so to me, these questions are, how do we want to care about our community? Maybe there are a couple of buildings that I personally find very creepy from a safety perspective. I don't want to wander around them late at night because there's nooks and cranny.
Yeah.
But I also find the new really beautiful glass building that they put up terrifying from an active shooter perspective. And so, again, we have to really think about safety for whom. What is actually levels of unsafeness that we need to take action on?
I myself actually think that PSU would benefit somewhere in the campus of having an actual homeless resource center to help the ones that are there wandering onto campus.
It would seem necessary I've been down there, and there's a whole camp on one side of the school. I mean, the entire street is just lined.
They do good about staying on the border up campus.
On the border, and they mostly in the sidewalk, but it's just absolutely full of people and tents and possessions.
And I know that at least when the previous police chief was there, probably through Peter, they were doing outreach to a lot of folks, but they're also not the people who should be doing the outreach. So, you know, one of the things we've been talking about is, what would it look like to have an outreach team at PSU?
I volunteer.
I think it sounds like somebody that could be reached every day.
Yep.
Someone that's keeping records of what people are reaching out to them about.
Right.
And who they are. So, you know, if Joe Schmo, you know, in the blue tent talks to you three times a day, you say, look, he needs a regular advocate, but Sally Sue in the green tent, she only needs a little bit of help. You know, she's got most of that under control, but she still needs an advocate in service.
And even if we were, you know, partnering with Join or Central City Concern or Transit, an organization that already has outreach workers, right? We've also got social work students and public health students who have to fulfill clinic hours and internship hours.
That seems like a good way to get some volunteer experience.
Yeah, and so there's lots of options there. It comes down in part to this question of, what are we trying to do with the research center? And we've got a pretty limited staff right now, and so we're going to be meeting with folks in the next couple of weeks to say, hey, we want to help, but we also can only do so much.
Yep.
We can't become the resource center for everyone on campus. That's not what we were scoped to do. And frankly, except for one of us, most of us would probably not be great at it.
And that's kind of why I made the distinction there of saying that we need a resource center on campus because it's not you guys. You guys are the research center.
Yeah, we're nerds in a very different way.
Yeah.
We're nice.
You guys aren't, you guys aren't prepped except for a couple of you for handling interactions with a lot of these people that are dealing with some of the situations.
Yeah. I am not a de-escalator. Yes. Let's just be very clear.
Myself, it's actually not even a de-escalation when it comes to me. It's just being humble to these people, just being hospitable. A lot of these people see me and they kind of see somewhat of a kindred spirit. I don't know if it's something they see in my eyes or what, but they know that I've been through it. And it's kind of instantly diffusing for a lot of them. They're just, hey, what's up, bud?
And like the people that have been in my building on a regular basis for the past few years, I've been able to get to the point that we'll say hi. One of the women no longer remembers me, but I know that I could get there again, right? It's, you know, she'll let me sit next to her, but I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I don't have that skill set.
And it's so, just reaching one person at a time.
It is. And that's who actually I had to call the police about last week and trying to figure out what outreach had been done with her. To me, it's modeling what we want other places to do. I can't go out and critique the city or a business for handling their stuff in a way that makes me annoyed if I can't even get my own institution to try to be a leader in this.
Yeah.
But I'm actually very optimistic because our current president is entirely on board with doing what we can.
Percy?
Steve Percy.
Yes, yeah. Steve. Thank you. I was blanking on his first name, but yes. Yeah.
He's
Percy.
Great. So I'm optimistic. But, you know, we still have those attitudes in our own buildings that, you know, one woman was very angry that someone who was homeless keeps stealing posters from the wall. And I'm like, okay, I get it.
I would redirect them to the Fifth Avenue free poster bin.
Or, you know, just don't put posters up for a while. I don't know. It just seemed like this is a lot. Yeah. So our other initiative areas are looking at innovative approaches to support unsheltered populations on the street. So that's thinking about the villages and sleeping pod communities that our architects have been working on. We've expanded that into a much larger research project. So we're going to be looking at the impacts of the villages on the people living in them, the people helping build them, and then the neighborhoods in which they're located.
So that was something I was curious to ask you about, is how you felt about transitional villages, especially peer-led villages, individuals that want to have an organized, clean space, a set number of people, maybe a kitchen, a bathroom, nice platforms.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's a big distinction between an organized camp that's tents and the villages, which is pod home.
Well, I think some people can't, I mean, you can't always afford a pod. So, like, there's one that I have reported on. There's Jason Barnes Landing.
That's near my
house. Is the transitional village that I've reported on. And I just actually released an article in Village Portland this past week, villageportland.com. It actually tells about their story that they've been trying to work with the city, that in their first days they made calls and reached out and said, this is where we are. These are our goals. This is who we are. How many people, you know, I went up there to the site many times. I took photos. It was clean. It was organized. There were never needles strewn about. There was never garbage. They actually would clean the trail from the people walking through that live in the houses and the apartments and that just drop trash on the ground because they know that they would get blamed for that garbage. And they still got notices. They still got swept over and over again. And they're not getting answers from the city on how to make their village real and approved. And they're not, they just really want to understand how to make that move forward because that's really what they want.
So that's interesting. I'd be interested to, maybe I can call the folks in the city because, like I said, they're actually right near my house. But my understanding is that there's supposed to be kind of like a point system, for lack of a better term, about what pushes you up to kind of sweeps level. And I don't remember what the things that were most problematic, but there's supposed to be a list. So you could
I've never actually heard about a list like this saying, you know, if you do so many bad things, maybe so much garbage or so many citations.
Yeah, maybe my understanding is off. But I thought there was some way that they were trying to say, we're going to kind of ignore you if it's not like the really public health.
So my
I've heard this as well, actually, in some of my reporting coming out of the joint office too, that there is a certain level of nuisance that once you get to the top, you're pretty much guaranteed to sleep.
So I actually interviewed an advocate of the Jason Burns Landing recently, and just looking into this as well, reading all sorts of articles, and it seems that these sweeps, these cleanups occur when the city gets calls or notifications from residents and people surrounding. I don't know if they have to be someone that lives in the area. I don't know if they have to, if they just call and leave a voicemail. I'm not sure the details of that, but it seems like if the city gets reports, if they hear about it, if they know you exist, that's what I seem to understand about this, is once they find out that you exist, they come and they post notices. Mm-hmm. And now you're on their radar. So if you show up again, anybody shows up again, they'll post notice again and again. And at Jason Burns Landing, this has been happening where they've actually run into this problem where they've had rangers and just official people coming through, mm-hmm, and sweeping and removing their personal possessions, actual bags and actual tents that's clearly not garbage. Even if they step away for maybe 10, 15 minutes to go get some water, help somebody else out, and they come back to grab their stuff and it's gone. And they don't always know when it's going to happen, which is part of that anxiety and stress you were talking about, that anguish that's destabilizing.
Yeah. And I mean, again, there's always like the stories about how things are supposed to be done versus how they're being done. And this is actually, I've been thinking about this the last month because I did see the notices go up for Jason Burns. And I was like, their camp looks really clean.
Yeah.
And I have photos of how clean it looked from that first week, before they had that July 10th sweep.
Yeah. And then beautiful. They came back and then they got more notices. And I'm like, okay, well, this seems to be a little bit not consistent with what I was told was supposed to happen. But it does the reality also become resident driven. But again, like there was supposed to be some kind of system that really brought it up to, are there public health threats that are legitimate?
Right.
And again, like, so I don't know. I mean, I think that this is one of these like really, really shitty situations where I don't know what the right answer is, right? We don't want to create a place where there's like platforms where everyone gets sent because that's literally like a refugee camp.
Right. Yeah. I know this camp has only 5 people right now. There was a consideration of a 6th. There was some people that couldn't handle some of the stress of this constant sweeps and the anguish. But there's only a handful of them, and it's not just open to everybody per se. It's a tight-knit community, people that are vetted, that have reached consensus approval, that know the rules. If you don't follow the rules, you don't stay. But they are willing to offer resources and direction to other people. Right. So if someone was coming through their camp, JBL had some toilets for a very short time, and they were willing to share them with anybody.
Yep.
Runners on the trail, moms, kids. Anyone that needed to use was willing to use them. And that's why they wanted to help. If you need to use the kitchen, they're going to help you use that. If you need to use the bathroom, you can use that. But the campsite portion of it was just for the residents. And the residents wanted to be able to help other people as well as themselves gain stability. And that's literally the opposite of what they are getting there. And it sounds like a story I've heard all across the city. There only seem to be less than a handful of villages that a person can name that exists.
Well, there's only 5 or 6 villages, depending on how you count them. Yeah. One bill that went through in the spring that could change things is a bill went through. Right, that it used to be that there could only be 1 or 2 urban campsites in a city. And a bill has gone through specifically to allow more transitional housing spaces.
And that's because of the quote-unquote housing crisis.
Yeah. And so that's now gone through. Apparently the yurt lobby was very excited about this. Hilarious, like, rando fact. There's a lot about yurts in the bill. but it should make it easier to establish urban campgrounds and village spaces. But, you know, I mean, the thing with villages also is that they take a lot of time and energy, right? And to me, this all falls into the area. What do we do in the short term to address the humanitarian issues while we're building, developing, preserving, and rehabbing housing?
See,
I know not everyone wants to go into housing, so I want to be clear, that's a whole different conversation. But like, I think that the other issue with some of the campsites is the vitriol from neighbors.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I have to say, I'm a public planner. I have been to a lot of community meetings. I'm a woman of color. I'm very acquainted with racism and the hate in yes. some of the St. John's neighborhood meetings around putting a village in has been so insane.
It's intense.
Nonstop.
And it's just, I mean, people getting up in meetings and with people who are houseless saying just horrible things.
You're nothing but a criminal, drug addict and stuff like this and stuff like that. Yeah.
And sometimes it's a person that may have a job that might be yep. a student somewhere, whether it's high school or college, but they don't have a stable home. And unfortunately, they sleep in a tent every night.
Yep.
And they're being called, they're being lumped in with all of these people that are on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Right. And even if someone is like drug addicted, right?
They still have a right to a place help. To be.
Yeah. I mean, that's my thing too. It's also like, we're into like fair housing territory, right? You're not, you don't get to vote on your neighbors.
I mean, drug addiction is actually listed as mental illness in mm-hmm. the DSM-5.
Yes.
I mean,
in the DSM-5 it is.
Yes. Yes. I don't know if it counts for protected class status. That's where I get confused, yeah. but I've actually been looking into this because I'm like, these discussions at these neighborhood meetings, I think could, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I'm trying to find a lawyer to make my crafty argument. So lawyers, if you're out there.
I got a connection for you.
Make my crafty argument that the discussions that are happening in neighborhood association meetings are violations of fair housing policies.
I believe they are.
Because people, you don't get to vote on your neighbors. And it doesn't matter if your neighbor is drug addicted. You don't get to vote them out of their home.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if they have a criminal background. You don't get to stop them from moving in.
And when it's housed and behind walls, there's actually a more of a chance you'll never know about your neighbors.
Right, that's what I'm saying. And like if I find out my neighbor is like a drug addict, I don't get to like
see it,
vote him out.
Yeah.
And how would a person even know that they would want a different life or want to get off whatever substance they're on or want to get in housing unless they had a taste of that? Because clearly something did not go well in the past that led them
down to that
position.
Yeah.
So there's not positive experiences, whether you go with whether it's, you know, primacy or recency, you know, the most important thing or the most recent one, they're remembering negative experiences about how housing works, how people are going to talk to you, treat you, what it costs, the hoops it goes through, the paperwork, the documents you need, the time it takes, and that's what gets to them.
Well, I also think that people don't understand that there's a number of people who become addicted to drugs and alcohol on the street.
Only yes. because they're out there and they don't have nowhere else to go. The only other people that are helping the homeless person is another homeless person, especially when someone is already on the streets a long time, has been addicted and sees a new street person and sees, oh, hey, look, they're still pretty clean. They're looking for a friend and I've been there. And that's where you get in those unhealthy relationships where it's not just domestic violence. There's a lot of different forms of abuse and you've got people that will leech off of someone and end up dragging them down into drug addiction and saying, oh, hey, let's go here. Let's go there. I'll help you out. We'll share a pack of smokes together.
Yep.
And next thing you know, they're camping out together and it's been 2 weeks and you just could never imagine that until you show up to some of these meetings and you hear some of these stories from people.
Yeah, and I think it's just, again, like neighbors, it's such an intense and visceral response. So we've gotten the comment. So you can go to a website and submit your complaints about camps.
What's that website? Do you know?
I don't remember what it's called, but it's through the city. It's through the Office of Management and Finance.
It's
the One Contact.
Oh, One Point of Contact.
One Point of Contact. I always just call it One Contact.
Yeah.
One Point of Contact. So we've actually gotten, I think, the last 6 months of all of the entries and are going through them. That's one of the studies we're looking at, is how are people talking about homelessness?
Yeah.
What is the language that they're using about homelessness? And what does that mean for how we need to be educating people? So at the neighborhood meetings, you'll see a lot of language around people who are houseless being pedophiles.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's like a real big jump, right? We've gone from maybe they're a thief, maybe they're a drug addict or maybe they're drug addicted to pedophile.
Yeah.
Like, that's like real insane jumps.
I have to wonder, it just seems like we're the society. We are just sort of throwing the grimy, undesirable labels and trying to group everybody together. Like, we're trying to make it easy and be like, oh, well, if we don't like that, we can see your dirty laundry. We could see you clipping your toenails and taking a bath in your tent. Then you must also be these other dirty things that we don't like and make us uncomfortable.
And every single one of them.
Right. And see, lumping them together. And it actually is making the problem worse. Mm-hmm. It's making it bigger, and it's hiding people that could otherwise make change.
One of the ways I like to express it is that the homeless don't have a closet to hide their skeleton in.
Yep, exactly.
So at least if someone is yelling at the street lamp post for stealing their cigarette lighter, you know exactly what is wrong with that person. For me, I think that knowledge is power. So it's better that than worrying about whether or not your neighbor is getting ammunition shipped to him every day through the package industry, and he's going to shoot something up.
And see, I know this problem is all this negativity towards the homeless is all across our nation, because I myself have been planning a trip here to New York, and hopefully the next couple of weeks. And I was like looking myself into what's going on in New York. I guess it's somewhere in like 66,000 or a little bit more homeless, and only 5,000 of those are on the streets in New York. And that's because they built a shelter system that utilizes hotels and motels that aren't really vacant or not really packed or whatever, and actually rent out the extra rooms to the city. The city provides the homeless that actually make it known that they are homeless and need a place. A room.
That's pretty cool. That sounds like it needs someone to call these places and see how many open rooms are each day.
But these places are not listed anywhere in any of the contact information for the city because of the fact of all this negativity towards the homeless that would be thrown at the hotel if it was known that those are where they're being housed.
I mean, we give people hotel and motel vouchers too.
Yeah.
New York also just has a ton more actual shelters. And that's a choice, right? Again, this is when we start to get into, we could build a lot more shelter, but are we making the pie bigger? Are we taking the pie? Are we taking away from the money that we would be using to build a permanent affordable housing?
And shelters doesn't necessarily mean that a person is going to be safe in those walls and roof, because it's shared space, it's communal everything. So somebody who's been through traumatic experiences, if they're a veteran, they've been through violence, severe discrimination and harassment, they may not be comfortable in a shelter environment and not be able to allow themselves to access those services for that fear.
And that's the argument for the villages, right? Is that it's a different kind of space.
Right. It allows autonomy and privacy.
And it's particularly supposed to be a space. I mean, they're small, right? And they're small by design. Jason Land, all of those places are small.
I think the largest square footage of any of those pods is 200.
Yeah. And then the number of people, the most I think is 20.
At the village. And I think the occupants for the pods is only 1 to 2 and will not exceed that by code.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that we are in a tough spot, right? So what do we do? Are there camping are there ways that we can set up camping so that things do work? For every one area where people are camping that's working out, there's probably areas that aren't working out.
Yeah.
What is the way to get this done effectively and quickly? I mean, I think that's the tough thing, is that we're doing a lot of pausing. Well, let's talk about this and think about this. And in the meantime, then sweeps happen.
It's the resistance to change. People have a hard time dealing with change and realizing that if I just have to wake up tomorrow and just do it different, that's it.
Yeah.
Do nothing but different. If I'm not following the routine I had the day before, then things will move forward, but it's uncomfortable. It's awkward. And so they take that time to stop and pause and assess, am I moving forward, am I doing this different thing acceptably, because it's so new?
And I think it's hard because, again, like, people are complaining so much about everything, right? I've got someone on campus complaining about poster theft. I'm looking at this RV sticker that you have in the studio, and there was an RV parked across the street on the block next to me, and people were complaining about it endlessly. And it's like, it's one RV.
Yeah.
Right. But the same office is getting all of these complaints.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be at the switchboard of that office. Oh, my goodness.
I have to wonder, who's going to start the board where everybody can post appreciation? Hey, I was broke down. I was at the park and my battery wouldn't start. And this vagrant looking person shuffled up to me. And then I realized that they were really friendly and they were nice and they helped me fix everything. And I learned his name was Joe and his favorite color is blue. Where are those stories in one place? We got the complaints showing up in one place. But where are the good things? Where are the neighbors that say, I support this village, I know these people, I live in this neighborhood? Where's the list of that?
I only came across one report online, one article, and it was basically homeless man returns his lost wallet. And that was
about
it.
I've seen that one, yeah. You know what? Maybe we should start collecting some of those stories. Because there's right, real serious advocates for Kenton Women's Village and for Hazelnut Grove. And they'll go out to other neighborhoods and do outreach and say, hey, you should welcome a village. There are people who do have, you know, stories about people who are houseless, who've done really incredible things. I think what scares me with some of those narratives, though, is that I worry that it reinforces the deserving poor narrative. And I also am like, why do we expect people who are not having a stable place to sleep to be in good moods and be nice? Like, I'm a real grumpy bitch if I don't get a good night's sleep for a while.
Yeah, if you're only getting 5 hours of sleep for weeks on end and you're eating maybe one meal a day and you've got to constantly worry about just finding the money to survive for meals each day, you're on the edge. You're living on the edge. And then people are wondering, why aren't you being friendly to me? Why aren't you saying hello? Why aren't you giving me phone calls, text messages? Why are you telling me you want to hang out, but then I don't hear back from you? Why aren't you bothering me all the time and telling me I'm important to you? And it's like that person has to constantly remind every single person, I'm in survival mode. Every day I have to survive. I think that's something that house people forget. Their survival mode is very different because they have those fallback amenities and luxuries. They can go home from a bad day and turn stuff off. They can step away from people, but someone sleeping in a tent or a vehicle is open to the public. Someone can just walk up to their window and start knocking on it and start talking to them. There's nowhere to go. You can't walk away. And your only response is to shut that person down quickly and say, don't talk to me. I'm in privacy mode. Yeah. My bedroom door is shut. And hopefully that person gets it. Usually a neighbor doesn't. But then again, there might be a neighbor that brings you a warm banana nut muffin and says, hey, I want to make sure everything's okay. Yeah. It's like you're out here in front of my house. Are you all right?
Yep. I can just leave a package here. And
I've heard of stories like that. Honestly, someone comes and just says, I'm not calling the cops. I just want to make sure you're okay. Those stories need to get out.
There was, when I was homeless on the Springwater Trail, there was this really nice, like, mid-70-year-old woman that would come by, and she would have, like, 12 baskets she would make up with toiletries and, like, muffins and a few little snacks and whatnot, and she would literally just go by the camps and, hi, guys, morning, here you go, bye. Wouldn't ask nothing from it, just, here you go.
I mean, could you imagine if someone would just, you know, find a friend somewhere and that needs help, that someone's house with resources, hey, you know, I've gotten to know you, we run into each other, you come into my building a lot, how about giving me a small thing of laundry and I'll wash it for you tonight and I'll meet you back here tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, little things like that can change a person's world, and it's infectious. That grumpy person that was surviving, realizing they're going to have clean underwear the next morning, I bet you they're going to be very friendly.
I mean,
or not, and it's okay.
They don't have to be, but you know what I mean? They're going to feel better about it. They're going to feel better about their own life. They're going to feel like they have made that friend and that connection, and that makes them validate it as a human.
That's also Free Hot Soup's model, right? It's a bunch of volunteers going out to feed people, and they're doing incredible work.
See, that's one of the main things I've come to understand, too, what's some of the driving force behind the homeless situation is that a lot of these people, myself, you know, some of them were missing or are missing a support network.
Yep.
And I believe it was Dr. Herschel that was just recently in town and was doing disability, homelessness, and aging. Or
yep, I might San have Francisco.
Had, I might have those words backwards or mixed up.
As long as you got all the right ones
close
together.
And she was sharing a piece of information in there that when she was like doing the research and whatnot, she found that one of the key factors was the missing mom, a maternal piece, like a maternal.
I think she found missing
social network.
But one of the other aspects
she found, it was deep. It
the
was
deep
near
social
the end.
Bond.
It was in the end of her event that she shared it. And it was basically that there is a lot that are missing a familial connection.
Yes, it's familial. It's having
and
a family member.
Maternal, too. Yeah. And
And that family members can be made along your way. In a sense, you can develop that kind of really deep bond with someone that you meet when you're 25 or 40 years old, you know. So there are people that are in groups on the street that make those families out there, but it's still not enough because everyone is now in that same position, and it's a lot harder for them to support each other when they all have nothing to share.
Right. And it is, I mean, these family networks, it's like, you know, I have a huge family, but I would say a huge portion of my cousins I never talk to.
Yeah.
And so, like, is my cousin going to really take me in if I needed it? And when you really start to think about the list of, your mom's not going to ever say no to you.
Yeah.
Right? In some very rare circumstances. It is true that some moms do say no.
Some moms
but
will.
Some moms, and I know that's for some of us, going to our moms is not a fun idea, right? But it is like...
My mom finally broke down after me being on the streets for 3 years, and just like, I got up in school, got cleaned up, trying to get myself put back together. Grandpa needed in-home caretaker, and she just, well... Corey's trying to do by himself.
And the thing is you wanted to do those things and you put yourself that you weren't forced. And there's something that I think is worth mentioning is that when you do have that support person, that familial bond, that mom, that cousin, whoever's going to take you in, often many of these people feel like they have a right to control that person's life. Oh, I've taken you in. I put shelter over your head. I now can control what you do. I get to know how much money you make all the time, what you're doing. And they're removing some of that autonomy in the guise of help. They're saying, I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to help you do this. And it's insulting almost. It says to them, I can't remember what that's called, but
it's paternalism.
That poverty blaming. It's saying you're poor because you're not smart.
Right.
It's your fault that you're poor, instead of saying there are deep systemic historical issues that create a vicious cycle of poverty. And then once you're there, it is so hard to find your way out. A lot of these success stories, the number one thing you hear in them is, this one person gave me a chance. This one person did this, and it was the saving grace. It was the turning point in someone's life. And without that change, that support, a lot of these people are just going in circles.
So one of the most proven way to help somebody who is homeless and who is severely mentally ill or drug addicted is a model called Housing First.
Yeah.
And that is when you get shelter, you get housing with no conditions on it. You're welcomed inside. You can come and go. The services are there if you want them. People will check in on you. They will help you. But it's up to you to decide what you want to actually take on. There's actually some policy changes happening at HUD that could threaten the ability to do that kind of programming as a consistent choice. The old school models of shelter, the ones that were very entrenched into religious institutions, were this punitive model, right? This paternalistic, you must do this because you were a bad person and lost your housing.
Right. You don't get to come and go. You don't get to have guests or friends over.
You have to do have to pray to our religious figure.
You have to show up to these appointments on these days, and they'll schedule your life and plan things.
Right. And instead, Housing First is the complete opposite of that.
And it lets people actually get back into society. I see that as the model that should work overall at the end of the day, because it's going to help people regain a sense of independence,
dignity,
pride
agency
in themselves. You're right. Yeah. Dignity. And they're going to know what they want to do by the ability to experience that, to say, I'm not going to have to fall in that place of fear for being lacking of resources and stability again. No matter what, I'm stable, so I can try to go to school. And if that doesn't work out, I could try these three different jobs until I find the one that works.
But I'm going to have a place to
but
stay.
But I'll still have a place to stay, and I can try. I don't have to worry about that.
I don't have to worry about failing.
And they're more likely, right. And because of that, they're likely to succeed eventually, because it's the more you fail overall, eventually you're going to succeed
over time. It gives them back their humanity. It
gives them back their, right.
Which brings me back into saying it's a humanitarian crisis.
Yep.
I want to thank you, Dr. Zapata, for coming in. I'll let you say goodbye to the guests.
All right. Thank you all so much for having me.
And I thank you as well.
Of course. Thank you very much, Marisa. It was lovely speaking with you. And always, Corey, this has been...
Trippy.
KBOO Portland.